RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Now, back in mid-March, I had Jan Rivers, public good champion, on talking about the UK NHS decision to ban puberty blockers and the WPATH leaks. And that was back on the 15th of March. And we thought we'd get Jan back to talk some more about the latest developments in this area. Jan Rivers, founder of Public Good and Genspect NZ. Welcome back to RCR. Thanks for coming back on, Jan.
Thank you very much, Paul. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. And it's really important that these issues around gender medicine get an airing.
Do we even call it medicine?
That's a really good, I mean, one of the, Genspect is an organisation that was founded internationally. There is now a New Zealand branch. I'm happily the spokesperson of that New Zealand branch, which I'm very honoured to be. And the organisation stands for a sensible approach to gender distress, a sensible approach to gender confusion. And that sensible approach does not recommend that social transition, surgery, and medication, puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones should be the first course of action. And the main reason for that is for children and young people, there's absolutely no idea about which of those children will persist in their gender confusion and who won't. And in fact, the majority of prepubertal children don't persist in their gender confusion, unless, of course, you socially transition them. And as they approach puberty, they panic because they realize that, you know, that there's a huge kind of a complex medicated future ahead of them.
Yeah. To medicate that sort of human development, I don't know. Our audience will have their opinions on that as well. Okay, I want to get on to the NHS ban on puberty blockers and get an update on that. And also, and we've got other stuff to talk about, but I thought we'd get to some of the latest stories. You can't get more immediate than the UK election. It's just happened. So have you done any thinking as to what that means for what we're talking about now?
Yeah, there are a number of different aspects, actually. One of the things that's happened is that Hilary Cass, Dr. Hilary Cass, who led the review of gender medicine in the UK, has been made a peer, so a peer in the House of Lords. And that's really important in terms of the UK, because it was a meeting at the House of Lords back in, I think, 2019, which actually allowed this whole issue to become open. And it was a time when various of the whistleblowers actually got to meet each other for the very first time. So those sort of elders who can appear in the UK House of Lords can be very useful resources, because they're not obliged to think about the five-year election cycle. I never thought I'd be saying this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but actually they do have a use. The second thing is that Wes Streeting, who is the new UK's new Labour Minister of Health, he made a statement within 24 hours of Cass review coming out that he would fully endorse it, and a government where he was the health minister would work to implement the Cass recommendations in full. And he had previously been somebody who people regarded as very on the other side on this issue. And it was almost as if the Cass report has given him the opportunity to really change his perspective, which is very refreshing. So the augurs for the UK in terms of gender medicine, I think, are reasonably hopeful at the moment. There is another huge piece of work that's going to be kicking off, and that's that the adult gender clinics didn't do the work that was required of them by the Cass review. So there are seven of them. One of them did do the work, but they will be going through another piece of work led by an independent expert, somebody, a peer possibly of Dr. Cass or somebody similar. And they will be taking the data from the children who went through the GIDS clinic and what has happened to them as they've entered the adult services. That's really interesting, because in Germany recently, there was a piece of research which showed that in early adulthood, something like 75% of girls had desisted from their gender confusion, and up to 50% of boys. The dates and the years are a bit more than I've committed to memory, but if that is also the case for the children who've gone through the Tavistock Clinic, that must can only have an enormous impact on the enthusiasm for gender medicine.
That should shut down that enthusiasm, doesn't it? Takes all the oxygen out of that room, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it seems there's always been this big debate about how it's only 1% or 2%, but typically what's happened is that the gender industry has canvassed its own membership, you know, gender confused people.
Right. Okay.
And so it hasn't actually sought out people who've detransitioned, who of course are not going to answer a survey about being transgender, you know, quite obviously. Yeah. So they've come up with this very low.
They're probably not approached. That's a possibility as well.
Well, that would be true indeed. Yes. The real thing that happened during that election was the collapse of the Conservative Party vote, particularly to the Reform Party and also to the Social Democrats. And the second thing was an enormous drop in the number of people who bothered to vote at all, something like 6 or 7%.
Saw that, yeah.
Now, the Labour Party, if it wants to remain in government and if it wants to become a popular government, is going to have to start to look at policies that address the concerns of those people who were loath to vote or who voted for the Reform Party.
That'll be interesting to see if they can do that.
As they sort of survey where they are, I think they will be doing the same sort of soul searching as our own Labour Party about whether the policies that they were pursuing so enthusiastically were the right ones. And I've recently heard, I think, David Parker saying, you know, and also Chris Hipkins talking about bread and butter issues and things that pull people together rather than things that drive people apart. Very wise choice, I would think. But we need to see the action that comes after that.
It just shows you that that part of our activity is fluid as well in the end, isn't it? Very fluid. You got to read which way the wind's going and go with it. All right. If it wasn't such a serious thing, that might not be too much of an issue, but this is very serious. Mm-hmm. All right. United States, release of court documents. What are they and what do they say?
Well, there are numerous pieces of litigation going on in the United States. There's a particular piece that's going on in Alabama, and there has been a ban on some aspects of gender medicine in Alabama, and the government are currently being sued by people who want to see that decision overturned. And as a result of that piece of proposed court case, there has been the pre-release of some of the important documents. And what they have shown, by and large, is that WPATH is not a scientific organization at all, that it's an activist organization. And in particular, what it has shown has been that WPATH has been highly susceptible to image management rather than scientific accuracy. And one of the things that has happened has been that when you create clinical guidelines, you carry out independent systematic reviews of the evidence. And they gave this work to Johns Hopkins University in the US. And they didn't like what Johns Hopkins told them, which was that the evidence was very poor. And they actually prevented them from publishing several of the pieces of the systematic review. I noticed this back in 2022 when the thing came out, when the WPATH Standards of Care 8, which were released at the end of 2022. And I tracked back to discover that the systematic reviews had never been completed. I didn't really know what that meant at the time, but this information shows that what has happened has been that Johns Hopkins were refused permission to publish the work that they had carried out. And what all bar one or two of the systematic pieces of work, the systematic assessments of the systematic assessment of the value of puberty blockers, I think, was one that did take place. And even that was exceedingly poor quality. There was exceedingly poor quality evidence, exactly the same as the CAS report. And so what WPATH did was they added another 600 or 700 citations, which had not been assessed in a systematic way. They just found them because they supported the case that they wanted to make. That's the least of it, really. One of the other things that has happened is that they changed the focus of the reports in order to provide they changed the focus of the standards in order to provide protection for clinicians who might be acting in a way that wasn't professionally credible. And possibly the most important thing that happened was that the age limits were removed within days of. There were two versions of the Standards of Care 8. The first version was published and it had age limits. So you had to be at least 16 to go on cross-sex hormones. You had to be at least 18 for phalloplasty or for mastectomy and so on. Those were all removed within several days when a new version was elicited and was published. And it turns out that the American Association of Pediatrics and the Assistant Secretary of Health, a transgender woman called Rachel Levine, both pressured WPATH to remove the age guidelines and said that they wouldn't support it unless that happened. Now, this is quite scandalous, isn't it?
Am I hearing what you're saying? I mean, crikey.
I just want to kind of... Oh, that's right. The systematic reviews were suppressed. There's been this political interference that I've mentioned. In the meantime, in the last few days, the Democratic government has said that it doesn't support gender medicine or surgery. And so what the sort of commentators on social media have called quiet quitting. And it's almost as if there's a retrenchment of... I suspect that what's happening... is that during the pre-election period, the people who take precedence are the policy people. But in the lead up to the election, the people who are demanding that the Democratic Party do their best to actually win the election are starting to rein in on some of the policies which are incredibly, unpopular.
Excuse me, they've made some sort of assessment and they've decided that it's not to their political advantage anymore, which means... Vulnerable children have been used as political tools and weapons.
It's astonishing, I think, that you're right in your assessment. And across the Democratic world, I mean, I think in California, there's actually a law, a sort of safe harbor law, which meant that if a child seeking puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones went to California, they would be able to receive that medication there, even if they couldn't in their home state. So absolutely, people have been used as, and people, children and young adults, vulnerable people, have been used as political pawns.
I think that's otherwise known as being thrown under a bus.
I spoke at the Inflection Point conference, and one of the things that was said there by Bob McCroskey, and I've heard it said, in fact, by Stella O'Malley, who is the head of GenSpect, which is that we've won the battle of ideas and truth. We have absolutely, there is no question that the evidence is in for the wisdom of putting young children on gender medicine. But the thing that has not been won is the battle of ideology, the battle of supposed kindness towards trans children.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really important difference. And I mean, there are ideas are one thing, but things that people believe in their heart, they believe that they're being kind, they believe that they're being compassionate, they believe that they're not making the mistakes that the world made when homosexual people and gay and lesbian looked for their rights in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of them feel so ashamed of what happened then that the next supposedly civil rights issue comes along, and the participants don't want to feel foolish, but they don't recognize that what's happening with this movement is not really civil rights. It's a movement of ideology, and it's a movement of child damage to children.
I have attended Let Kids Be Kids meeting.
Ah, yes.
They went through the RSE material. Mm-hmm. And I came out, and I'll say this, I came out thinking, we're talking about child sacrifice, actually, mm-hmm. in the end. And this is the really pointy end of it, where it actually happens under the knife. Mm-hmm. But it's all about kind of sacrificing children to something, I don't know what, by taking away their inalienable right to be a kid and to grow up a human being and go through the processes that make us human. Mm. They're being attacked and ripped away. And I know that sort of like sounds ancient or something that the Mayans did or whatever, but it seems to be some kind of form of it to me.
It's a hard thing to talk about, really, because, as you say, it sounds so strange. But I think that what is happening is that children are becoming props for transgender adults.
Yeah, and they're disposable. There's the sacrifice bit, you see?
Yes. I mean, there is a kind of conflict, and I think we're going to go on to talk about this later, about the Law Commission review. But to me, there is a whole series of international conventions that we've signed up to. The International Convention on Human Rights, the one on civil and political rights, the one on child rights, the CEDAW Convention that protects women. And all of these things have paragraphs in them that protect children. For example, in the International Declaration of Human Rights, there's a line about the ability to found a family.
Yeah.
You can't found a family if you've been made infertile by taking puberty blockers and then going on to cross-sex hormones. So there is a whole lot of thinking about the right of a child to have an open future. And that speaks to exactly what you're saying, that having to forego that right is really a form of child abuse.
Yeah.
And the same applies in the International Convention on Children's Rights from 1998. The provisions there are about the idea that a child needs a family and a child needs guidance and a child needs responsible adult supervision. And the way that that interacts with gender medicine is that a 14-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old does not have the insight into who they're going to become as an adult. And responsible adults have to take that decision for them. But we've got a kind of misshapen concept of adulthood now, which is that clinicians, parents, family members, relatives are being encouraged to think that, to respond to a kind of internal psychic reality of gender, rather than actually addressing this, you know, young people as children who need support and help in order to become adults. And that whole thing about, I mean, if you take puberty blockers, then you don't go through that whole process of emotional and mental maturation.
No, you steal it. You take it away. You rob the human of it. And that is, it's immoral.
Yes. Yes, and I think it, yes, sorry.
I think it needs to be called out for what it is. I know I can say that. But I don't think I'm wrong. All right, we better get a wiggle on time. Where is Safe and Reversible now in the New Zealand health system or environment? Because it used to be there and then it went away. And what's happened now?
So the Ministry of Health removed the words, I think, in April 2022 from their website. And as a result of that, there were questions made to the ministry to explain why they had removed that information. And they removed it because they were aware of the various things which were taking place across Europe, you know, particularly what was happening at the Tavistock Clinic in the UK. But what has happened, and for 18 months that was fine, but what has happened with the dissolution of the DHBs and the creation of one huge health department, has that information has now reappeared on a Health New Zealand Te Whatuora website called HealthPoint. And I can't quote the exact wording, but what it basically says is that the puberty blockers are safe and their discontinuation will allow puberty to resume as normal. So basically they're saying that puberty blockers are safe and fully reversible. Some of my colleagues that I've been working in GenSpec with have sought OIAs to find, to understand.
But they can't base that on anything, can they?
Well, what it means, and it sort of speaks to the political impasse that we've got at the moment, which is that we know that a review of puberty blockers has taken place at the Ministry of Health. We know that it's been completed. We know that it's been peer reviewed, but it so far hasn't been released. We also know that PATHA are in the process and have been funded to create new guidelines. And those new guidelines are going to be written on, with their basis, is the WPATH Standards of Care 8, which are, we now know are subject to these incredible problems of a lack of proper research, suppression of information, political interference, clinical self-interest. And it seems wrong, it seems slightly wrong to me, that we should be basing our New Zealand guidelines on a document which is now fully discredited and whose information is appearing through the court system by an organisation, PATHA, in New Zealand, whose own previous set of standards came last but one in the CAS report. They were the worst but one of about 20 or 21 different standards of care which had been done for gender medicine across the world. And so it seems to me that we shouldn't be giving money to an organisation to use discredited guidelines whose own practice around the creation of guidelines is very poor, and moreover, who are prepared, in the case of the CAS report, to lie about the CAS report, to say that it ignored all but 2% of the research. This is not an organisation that is speaking or acting in good faith, and it's not an organisation as well that's open to seeing new information. Like, all of this information comes out from research across the world, and it's as if PATHA is immune to it. Not only is it immune to it, it regards it as being transphobic. And that's a serious problem. If we've got a professional organisation looking at gender medicine who are completely unwilling to entertain the idea of emerging new evidence that might
change their approach. A blasphemy against the order, I think, is probably one way of seeing it, that they see it. I'm interested, the commonality in WPATH and PATHA is the P, I reckon. And you talked about WPATH being more of a kind of a marketing agency for this ideology. That P stands for professional. I've always been curious why they chose that. And I think that's a masking word. It gives a credibility that's not a medical credibility, but professionals. Who are these professionals? This is not a profession. It's never been a profession.
No. In the case of PATHA, I think there were less than a fifth of the original members were people who were clinicians. So most of the people were activists.
Professional activists.
Well, people who worked within the sort of gender rainbow industry within New Zealand. That was the case with PATHA, which is the New Zealand organisation. It's well known that WPATH has been subject to political and activist pressure for at least the last two iterations of its standards of care, so the 2012 and the 2022 versions. And it has been recognised as a problem. I mean, it's great to create medical guidelines where you take account of the affected cohort, the population of people. And you would do that for diabetes, and you would do it for Alzheimer's. You do it for all sorts of medical conditions is to consider the acceptability to the cohort of the treatments that you're providing. But when you defer in very, very serious ways to demands that are unrealistic and unrequired, then that becomes a serious problem. So, for example, in the New Zealand standards at the moment, there is a provision to provide progesterone to men who want to appear more like women. There is absolutely no clinical indication for the progesterone except that the community demands it.
Do they get what they want every time they ask?
I mean, I think one of the things that is happening is that there is a level of pressure that the transgender community and their allies can apply, which is unusual in many respects.
Yeah, how do we explain that? I always wonder, what have they got on some people, you know, to have them so engaged in this when it's obvious most rational, normal, I don't know if that's a word, citizens know that this, the alarm bells are ringing so loud, yet that doesn't seem to register.
I've got an interesting, and I can't really comment on that directly, but I've got an interesting anecdote. And it's that one of the organisations that agreed with CASS was the UK College of Psychotherapists, UKCP. And what they did, their board decided that they would put out a statement to indicate that they would no longer carry out affirmative care.
Yeah.
In the old model, and that they would have their practice dedicated to exploration of the experience of young children.
Yeah.
The activists within the organisation protested against that, and they threatened to sack the entire board. And that threw the whole organisation. So this is like the equivalent of our NZAP, the New Zealand Association of Psychotherapists. Actually, no, it's the equivalent of our psychotherapy board. So it is the actual registration board, the one that makes sure that psychotherapists working to a high standard, make sure that there are provisions in place for complaints, make sure that everyone who is working as a psychotherapist is properly qualified. What happened with that organisation was that they had to hold a vote about whether to sack the board or not. And what happened in the vote was that 80% of the membership voted to retain the board and therefore to continue with a new kind of process which would no longer deal with affirmation but would explore the conditions or the circumstances of the children that and young people that came for psychotherapy. And what that speaks to me of is that there is a quality of bullying and a quality of righteousness on behalf of the people who think that gender medicine is a good idea that is frankly intimidating. Just this morning, I attended a Free Speech Union event in the UK, which was some of the doctors and others who had been involved in exposing what was going on at the Tavistock Clinic. And they described some of the things that had happened to them as a result of their activism. Like one of the women is a former professor, a woman called Michelle Moore, and she and others put out a book called Inventing the Transgender Child. When they did that, the Tavistock Clinic, the sort of might of the NHS, threatened to take them to court. And they were all absolutely terrified with the prospect that they might lose their homes if they published. And they were able to get some legal advice to show them that basically the Tavistock was a paper tiger. But this is an indicative of the level of intimidation. And we can be sure that that level of I know that that level of intimidation is applying in New Zealand as well. Mm. People are being told if they speak out that they will be reported to the New Zealand Medical Council or to the psychotherapy board. In fact, it's happening. And so there is a real chilling effect. Which is unwarranted given how strong the evidence that the New Zealand approach to gender medicine is not an appropriate one.
Not appropriate people, if you want to trust them with your kids. Sounds like to me. All right. We are running quite high on time here. A couple of quick answers. And Patha, did they dismiss the CAS report? 300 pages, that report, and they dismissed it in a day. You can't read that in a day and digest it and process it and make comments about it, can you?
Not at all. No, impossible. I mean, it's complex, detailed stuff, and incredibly nuanced as well. I mean, it was introduced. The introduction contained an essay directed at the young people who it would affect, and it was written with incredible compassion and understanding. And so we can only gauge that the response was entirely ideological and really not based on the evidence at all. One of the things that I think is really important at the moment is that Reality Check Radio is one of the organizations that will cover these ideas.
Exactly.
I've done some analysis of publishing empire, and the stories that would cover this perspective run at between 40 and 60 to 1. Like, there might be one critical story to 40 or 60 puff pieces about the benefits of transgender medicine, about the wonderful thing of being transgender, about all manner of aspects of, but there is very little coverage. So basically what I think that means is that organizations like PETHA, organizations like Inside Out, can play with the truth with almost no consequences.
Yeah, it's completely wide open for them. Mm. And people assign credibility to that sort of reportage if they're not sort of savvy. And unfortunately, many people aren't. Okay, let's get on to quickly NHS ban on puberty blockers. Have there been developments there in the time we spoke last in mid-March?
One of the good things that has happened is that the Scottish government has decided in just the last week or so that they too will follow the UK advice.
Okay, well, yeah, the Scots. There you go.
Yes.
Leave it to the Scots. And some comments to finish on a Law Commission piece, La Tangata, a review of the protections in the Human Rights Act 93 for people who are transgender, people who are non-binary, and people with innate, this is a new one, I haven't heard this one before, innate variations of sex characteristics. It's an issues paper. Is there anything, any points in that? We don't have much time, but any points in that you'd like to mention or highlight?
Oh, I think it's most interesting because it differs quite considerably from other Law Commission issues papers that I have looked at.
Yeah.
And one of the main issues is that they only took evidence from one perspective in developing the issues paper. So the perspective that they took was the perspective of transgender people, and also the conditions of and some intersex people who broadly regard themselves as being part of the rainbow community. So
okay.
That's not the case for all people with conditions of sexual development by any means. And it is unusual in that it uses quite fully the language of gender ideology, and it maintains that the only people who think that sex is immutable are these weird gender critical people, as if somehow the broad population thinks that sex is something that might be one thing one day and another thing another day.
No, we don't.
Well, I think it's almost as if, in my view, and there will be different views, it's almost as if they've given the pen to the activists and said, what do you want in here? And it makes it very difficult for people who might want to have some really nuanced discussion about what would be really good about a law that protects people with differences of gender expression and identity. And one of the really difficult things is that there's an asymmetry there. What's great about having a law that protects people who look like, don't look typical for their sex, who claim to be transgender, but doesn't protect people who don't look typical for their sex, who don't claim to be transgender? So if you're a butch lesbian or a very effeminate man and you say, well, I'm a man or I'm a butch lesbian, then you're not going to be protected. Whereas if you say, I'm now a trans man, you know, you will be protected. That's to build asymmetry and unfairness into legislation. So I think that's right at the outset, that's a real problem.
Just to end on, we've had Sal Grover on here, Tickle versus Giggle.
Yep.
Yeah, and she's doing a tour of the country at the moment. Mm-hmm. And she put up on X very recently, yesterday actually, trans activists tried to protest the event I spoke at last night. That's in New Zealand. I won't say where it was. However, we secretly changed the venue, and so for the better part of 2 hours, they were shouting at an empty room. These are the lengths women have to go to just to speak about women's rights. But she's put this up from an account called Queer Endurance. I don't know if you've heard of them. Uh-huh. The protest is indoors. There are security cameras. Be mindful of escalation that will likely be recorded. Additionally, TERF groups are video happy and have doxxed people in the past. Be aware of their cameras and block them with signs and banners if necessary. So, you know, really facing off now, aren't we?
There is an escalation, and I find it very worrying. And I did approach a number of people in the last government to say that this is an area of social of increasing social discohesion. I don't think that's the right word, but
I know what you mean.
And it needs leadership. It needs leadership, and it needs intensive care to undo the damage that's been done. And I think that what is happening in New Zealand is incredible hidden turbulence. There are disputes in workplaces which are almost like war zones. There are disputes in families. There are friendship groups that are being broken apart. It's very difficult if you have someone in your social circle who has a child who they're giving puberty blockers to, because that person is having to lie to themselves about very real harm that they're doing to their own children. And such people in organizations are having incredible effects on those organizations. Huge areas of conversation become unsayable.
Yeah.
And that's a serious problem, and it needs serious leadership. And that leadership is lacking at the moment. And I think that one of the things that is a real concern of mine is that the National Party are trying to take a hands-off approach to this. And I think that is incredibly unwise, because these issues are changing very, very rapidly, and the escalation is quite considerable, and it's not going to be solved by a leadership that decides that they can be hands-off and it's all a bit embarrassing and we don't want to lose our popularity.
Wow. What are we going to do? I suppose you just keep on doing what you're doing. Jan Rivers, founder of Public Good and GenSpect here in New Zealand, thanks for coming on again. I really appreciate it.
And thank you very much for the opportunity, Paul. I really appreciate it too.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.